listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Reporting to us from Managua, Nicaragua.
I guess we start out first with an RIP for Bill Blum.
Yeah, for me, Bill Blum was a great inspiration because he was so consistently articulate in his expression of his profound anti-imperialism. And people won't have agreed with Bill Blum about everything that he wrote. But his fundamental insights were almost invariably extremely helpful and valuable. So for anybody that's in looking at what has been the role of the United States in particular attacking the majority world, William Blum is a genuine authority. And for me, perhaps I shouldn't say this because it's so invidious, but Bill Blum to me was far more important than Noam Chomsky.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, he comes out of the Department of State. He wanted to be a Foreign Service officer and had his eyes opened by what he saw about the Vietnam War. Opens an alternative newspaper, the Washington Free Press, the first alternative paper in the capital at that period, exposes the CIA in 1969, 2 years later, with the names and addresses of more than 200 CIA employees. And he was in Chile during Allende's time when the U.S. took out the elected government and imposed, in essence, a military fascist dictatorship for lasted a couple of decades. He was in London with Philip Agee exposing the CIA and its misdeeds there. And he's been writing. He's, you know, you say that he is, you know, has been a an articulate voice. He's also been a prolific one. He's written a number of books that expose a whole lot of stuff about what really goes on behind the curtain here.
Yeah, Killing Hope. That's a seminal book.
Yeah, Killing Hope. I was just saying before we went on, if you, just looking at the index to this book, it's like a history of the U.S. misdeeds. Here's the various places that it's Killing Hope, U.S. military and CIA interventions since World War II. William Blum with Zed Books in London was the publisher. So here's interventions. Chapter 1, China. Chapter 2, Italy. Chapter 3, Greece. It goes down to chapter 56, which is the American Empire. So 55 is Haiti. It's just about every square inch of planet Earth is on here.
Right.
And in other books...
It reflects the reality, right?
That's right. And that is the period since World War II. He also wrote a book detailing U.S. military interventions from 1798 until 1945. Right. So the whole history of U.S. foreign policy as you know, war crime and crime against humanity, like an ongoing serial, makes RICO look like a, you know, playground violation, foreign policy of the U.S., he details.
Yeah, and for people in Latin America, he has been a great historian of U.S. intervention in the continent, which continues to this very day, of course.
Yeah, even in Central America, where you are, this with respect to Nicaragua, for one example.
Yeah, Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, and so many different countries. And I think the U.S. was even involved in Grenada, of course.
Of course.
The constant sanctions and assault. Economic assault, psychological warfare assault, and even chemical warfare assault on Cuba. And they even got involved in Suriname. The best thing to do is to read Bill Blum's books to get an idea of the extent of U.S. intervention in the region.
Right, yep.
And so,
sorry.
Maybe we should move on and look at some of the contemporary stuff that Bill would be documenting today if he were with us.
Right, he probably still has notes on his desk about some of these things. Yeah, let's jump right in. I want to start in Venezuela. There are two things. Number one, the municipal elections that took place this past weekend, and the successful conclusion of those elections yet again in favor of the Socialist Party, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela. And also echoes of days past, Russian airplanes visiting Venezuela on maneuvers with Venezuela's Air Force, and a little PR fallout from that.
Yeah, in Venezuela over the weekend, the elections were again held in a very orderly, peaceful way. The opposition apparently have given up trying to disrupt those electoral processes because they've completely failed to do so in the past. And the elections were again an overwhelming victory for the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, it's quite a complex system that they have for these municipal. It's the election of municipal councils. And I think in total there are something like almost around 600, perhaps a little more if you include the Indigenous Peoples List. But on one list, and I think the PSUV came out with something like 140 out of 160 something councils, and on another list they came out with 400 and something out of 450 councils, something like that. So it was an overwhelming win. I haven't seen the figures for the turnout, but in municipal elections across the continent, the turnout is usually much lower than for national legislative or presidential elections. So nobody should take seriously any opposition claims that may surface about the lack of democratic validation because of the low turnout, because that's what happens in every country in Latin America. This is an extremely encouraging result for Nicolas Maduro, despite the continuing economic destabilization, in particular price speculation and speculation about the currency rate. The domestic price speculation, of course, is encouraged by opposition business people supporting the Venezuelan opposition, and also they collaborate with external agents like the Dollar Today scam that artificially speculates about the exchange rate of the Venezuelan currency, too, and then that too encourages the price spiral that is so damaging to ordinary working people in Venezuela.
Yeah, they're trying to tank the economy, I mean, one of the methods is that they're trying to undermine the currency. It's a repeated scenario that gets played out, the attacks on the currency.
It's not clear yet if they've completely succeeded, because it looks as though some of the measures that that Nicolas Maduro and his government have taken in relation to the petro, in the cryptocurrency, the Venezuela's cryptocurrency, they've now stated that all their oil transactions will be conducted in petro.
Right.
So that's another blow to the dollar.
Right.
And one has to remember that you have to put that in the global context where Iran, Russia, and China.
Right.
In particular, are taking measures to abandon the dollar for all kinds of purposes, for trade transactions, but in particular for their energy transactions, oil and gas transactions.
Yep.
So, you know, that's another kind of what I regard as another ratchet down in the stability of the United States' dominance, in particular of the economic and financial structures.
Right.
That prevail at the moment.
And I think we see the flip side of that in this election. The various attacks and, you know, the supply line, issues, all of the things that have been done to try to thwart the development of the economy over the past few years, the government has been finally, in the last year or two, becoming much more assertive in fighting back. The question was always, how will the people respond? And this is the second election in a row after that, you know, very strong response from the government has been implemented, where the people are rewarding them with like 90% plus of the vote.
Right. And so, it is a strong validation of the government of Nicolas Maduro. Yeah. And one should remember that in January, Nicolas Maduro will assume the presidency for another presidential term.
Right.
Following the elections earlier this year.
Yep. So this is ratification of that, too, of course.
The other thing, as you point out, that has happened that is of great interest in Venezuela is that Russian military airplanes are on maneuvers with Venezuela's Air Force. At the moment, and that has provoked a not very happy response from Mike Pompeo.
Pompeo, the Secretary of State, the U.S. Foreign Minister, basically. Yeah.
So he's not happy about that.
Yeah.
But and as you pointed out in our conversation earlier, and the United States can hardly complain about what has become a routine visit in some ways by Russian airplanes to Venezuela, because it's not the first time that these airplanes, the Tu-160s, have visited Venezuela and taken part in maneuvers in Venezuela. They did at least 2 years ago, and I'm not sure if it's an annual thing that they do now or not, but it's certainly not the first time. The United States shouldn't be surprised about this visit, and nor have they any moral authority to complain about it, because they've completely militarized all their frontiers with the Russian Federation.
I mean, Pompeo's comments in particular, the particularly ironic part, is that he accused Moscow of squandering public funds by sending two bombers on maneuvers to Venezuela, that like two dictators, Maduro and Putin, that's how he put it, were squandering public funds doing these things. And so Dmitry Peskov, who is the spokesperson for President Vladimir Putin, was like, are you kidding me? Your U.S. military budget is enough to support all of Africa. There's a billion people that live in Africa. And they suggested that maybe Trump is going to be issuing a dumb as a rock tweet about this Secretary of State like he did recently about Tillerson.
Yeah, well, and the Russian Federation's budget is, and I read in a recent article on a website, I'm not sure if it was Strategic Culture, but one of those, the Russian Federation's military budget is around $50 billion. And as you pointed out to me before we started our conversation, the United States budget is $750 billion.
Right.
No? So,
yep.
No, that, and perhaps the reason Pompeo is so concerned about this apparently routine visit by Russian military planes to Venezuela is that it comes after President Vladimir Putin earlier this year explained to the United States that Russia has developed very advanced weapon systems superior to anything that the United States currently has, including hypersonic missiles that some U.S. military analysts have said the United States has no response to.
Right.
And so you now have a situation where, along with these pretty routine visits by Russian military aircraft to Venezuela, the United States is nervously realizing that those planes can carry weapon systems to which they have no response.
Yeah.
So perhaps they'll be a bit more careful about their aggressive remarks about possible military intervention in Venezuela. And Trump said that that option was on the table. When did he say that? Was it 2017?
Yeah, since he took office, and that was either last year or this year. So yeah.
Yeah. So and it's like it's one of these very subtle, or perhaps not so subtle, reminders by the Russians in a very low key way that the United States is no longer able to call the shots as it used to.
Right.
Even Latin America, which the United States has traditionally regarded as its backyard.
Yeah.
So, and as you pointed out earlier, that you know the potential for that is that develops into a situation similar to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Let's hope it doesn't.
That's right. Yeah, let's hope it doesn't for sure. I guess you want to move on to Panama, and you know, with Russia.
Yeah.
You know, flying, joint maneuvers with Venezuela, military maneuvers. President Xi is touring the neighborhood, and he's got his checkbook with him.
Yeah, and when we spoke last, I think it was the day that President Xi visited Panama, and
yes.
it just confirms what we said last week, that. And I've forgotten how many agreements that they signed, but there you have Panama and the United States, kind of little tax haven paradise for all the corrupt business people in the United States and their corrupt corporations where they launder money through. And you have China casually walking in and saying, right, well, they're our allies now. And that does seem to be the case because
right.
In Panama's president, is it Varela? President Varela signed various agreements with President Xi, and they have abandoned Taiwan for
yeah.
the People's Republic of China. Diplomatically, they have dropped their recognition of Taiwan, and they now formally recognize the People's Republic of China. That has all kinds of implications for U.S. policy in the region, in particular trade policy. And it also has implications for the United States in terms of its the way it's always regarded Panama as a financial fiefdom, but also as a strategic fiefdom in terms of the Panama Canal.
Right.
So in that, you know, I'm the they threw a hissy fit about the Interoceanic Canal proposed for Nicaragua, which is currently looks as though it's been mothballed, but not forgotten about entirely. But now they're faced with a situation where the Panama Canal is located in a country that has formally recognized the People's Republic of China and has signed a series of and President Xi referred to the partnership with China, with Panama, sorry, as a strategic partnership. And that, you know, that phrase has a very strong meaning in terms of United States foreign policy in the region.
It's interesting also, this is like an apparent contradiction, but Nicaragua has had strong trade relations with Taipei, with Taiwan, stronger than with China, right? Is that still true?
That takes, sorry, Don.
Is that still true?
Yeah, I'm very much so. And you see, when the Sandinista Front was in government in the 1980s, it didn't have very good relations with the People's Republic of China. People's Republic of China did next to nothing to support the Nicaraguan Revolution,
right,
which was very strongly supported by the Russian by the Soviet Union at that time. And so during the period of the Liberal Party governments, the right-wing neoliberal governments that took the first of those took power in 1990 after at the end of the war. And they were in power for 17 years. And during those 17 years, they built up a very strong development cooperation relationship with Taiwan. And when President Ortega took office in 2007, what he did was he was very careful not to mess up Nicaragua's existing diplomatic relations at that time with its existing partners, including Taiwan. And what he did, what he and his administration did, was diversify those relations. They developed their relations with Iran. They developed their relationship with Venezuela. They developed their relationship with other progressive governments in Latin America that the previous neoliberal governments had tended to neglect. And they also, of course, reinforced their traditional relationship with Cuba and the Russian Federation and so forth. And that's a characteristic of Nicaragua's foreign policy, that they're very careful to balance their relations between countries that are allies of the United States and countries that are not allies of the United States, based on the principle of non-intervention. It's none of our business what you do in your country, and we expect you to take the same position as regards events in our country. So, and that's been very successful in terms of diversifying Nicaragua's international relations. So then, now I think El Salvador has also recognized the People's Republic of China. I think we mentioned in a previous program that the United States has warned these countries that are developing their relations with the People's Republic of China that the United States takes a very dim view of what they're doing. But that's just another indication of the way U.S. influence and power is ratcheting down, even in what it's traditionally regarded as its playground, its backyard, Latin America.
Right.
So what has been their response to this? Well, their response has been to try and isolate Venezuela, to maintain its isolation of Cuba. They've attacked and tried to overthrow the government here in Nicaragua, without success. But they're consolidating that assault on Nicaragua's national sovereignty, and now they've started in Bolivia, of course. And over the last couple of weeks in Bolivia, the political opposition there have tried to provoke unrest in the country around the bid by Evo Morales to stand for re-election along with his current vice president Alvaro Garcia Linera. And the electoral authority in Bolivia has approved that. The United Nations has validated that electoral process with the candidate of Evo Morales. And in that context, what the Bolivian opposition, supported, of course, by the United States, has done is engage in violent protests in which a woman street seller was killed as a result of their violence. And that's something another very significant event in Bolivia in relation to that has been the declaration by the Episcopal Conference of the Catholic Church in Bolivia that they reject the candidacy of Evo Morales to stand for president in next year's elections. And that both those events, the opposition violence that killed and somebody who had nothing to do with politics, just a woman street seller who was a victim of their violence, and this declaration by the Bolivian bishops faithfully reflects previous events in Venezuela and the recent events this year in Nicaragua. Right. So we can expect over the next few months to see that process develop, and there'll be a kind of another attempted coup d'etat involving the Catholic Church, the Bolivian opposition business sector, Bolivian opposition politicians, the NGO sector in Bolivia, which is funded almost entirely from the countries of the United States and its NATO country allies.
Right.
And so we'll see another cycle of violence similar to what we've seen over the last couple of years in Venezuela and Nicaragua, in Bolivia over the next few months. And it's like clockwork. You can always predict it.
Yeah, it's like somebody got their hands on Bolton's comic book that outlines how to do this stuff, and they're spreading it around the region, like going back to another round of the stuff that they did 20 years ago again.
Yeah, and so we can expect that, but then there's good stuff and bad stuff happening as well. In Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador has started implementing his program. It remains to be seen how successful he's going to be faced with the opposition that he will face from the entrenched right-wing interests in Mexico, in the business elite, in the armed forces, and so on. And just in the first week, I think, of his presidency, and just to give an idea of the social crisis that Mexico has, I think a total of 250 people were murdered in just one week. But there's a lot of hope about Andrés Manuel López Obrador being able to restructure the oil industry, restructure the economy for small and medium-sized businesses, a whole series of measures, including trying to secure justice for the victims of the violence that has plagued Mexico for years now, in particular the parents of the 43 students that were disappeared in Ayotzinapa what was that, 3 years ago now?
Yeah, a while ago, yeah.
Who still haven't had justice. So, and then something that's a bit more negative is that in Brazil, the current president, Michel Temer, who's coming to the end of his presidency this month, he's decreed the militarization of the Roraima department up in northern Brazil on the Venezuelan border, ostensibly as a result of problems provoked by Venezuelan migrants into that department, which is a very impoverished department up in the north of Brazil.
Right.
And so, you know, who knows what's really going on there, but that's not a good sign. And at the same time, another indication of how far right, how far to the political right Brazil's administration is likely to go under Bolsonaro. Jair Bolsonaro, the incoming president, who many people regard as an outright fascist,
yeah.
And his proposed foreign minister, a guy called Araújo, has confirmed that Brazil, along with Chile and the Dominican Republic, is going to reject the recent guidelines on migration that were agreed at a UN meeting. I've forgotten where the UN meeting was now, but it was a very important meeting trying to set up agreed international guidelines about the way countries should treat migrants. And various countries have rejected them, those guidelines. Of course, the United States didn't even, I'm not even sure that it was at the meeting, but if it did, it certainly rejected them. But in Latin America, so far, Chile, Dominican Republic, and now Brazil have rejected those guidelines, which are not binding in statutory terms, but the hope was that they'd be taken into account,
right,
by internal jurisdictions when the courts in any given country were, right, considering cases involving migrants from other countries. So, you know, and that's another indication of how far to the right Brazil is moving. And while Brazil is agreeing that as its future policy, in Mexico, the authorities there under President López Obrador are trying to restructure their policy towards migrants. In particular, they're trying to reorganize the way that they meet the needs of migrants from Central America.
We'll have to pick that up next week because we're out of time. But of course, that makes sense. All right, Tony, thank you very much. We'll speak with you again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has declared multilateralism in international affairs a failure. What is needed, according to him, is a new liberal order led by the United States. Such an order calls into question some important issues. Does this mean the universalization of American law and limited sovereignty for the rest of the world? Crosstalking Pax Americana, I'm joined by my guest, James Jatris in Washington. He's a former U.S. diplomat and former advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. In New York, we have Daniel Lazar. He's an author and freelance journalist who writes frequently about the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the U.S. Constitution. And in Madrid, we cross to Manuel Lopez Linares. He is the author of Pax Americana, and he's a university lecturer as well as a contributor at Expansion. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Jim, let me go to you first in Washington. I thought we already had Pax Americana. That's why I'm calling this program Pax Americana 2.0, because it seems like Mr. Pompeo has some interesting ideas. Presenting it to the to international diplomats at the U.S. Marshall Fund, I thought it was quite interesting, their reaction. It was really quite tepid. It was kind of very quiet clapping here. It just looks like unilateralism to me, and I thought the U.S. created multilateral organizations after the Second World War to create a more stable order. It seems now, get rid of the U.N., the walk away from the Paris climate deal, which I don't have a problem with, the International Court of Justice. I could go on and on about all of these relationships and agreements. How does walking away from all of them and more make it safer for the world, including the United States? Go ahead, Jim.
Well, it doesn't make it safer, and I think the problem is less unilateralism per se, but this defiance for the rule of law, not only internationally, but even our own Constitution. I think Mr. Pompeo's speech was a triumph of misdirection, that it was essentially old neoconservative wine poured into an America First rhetorical bottle. It was Woodrow Wilson masquerading as Pat Buchanan. I think he or his speechwriter was trying to give the impression this is what Mr. Trump promised in 2016. What he's really giving us is what has been destroying America and the world for the last 30 years, where we get to be the uber sovereign over the entire planet and tell everybody else to do, but we don't actually look out for our own narrow national interests. I mean, we can send troops illegally to Syria, but we can't send them to our own border to defend that.
Good point. Daniel, is this the universalization of American law? Because, I mean, we have this situation with a Chinese national that was detained in Canada, Huawei, the Chinese company here. As we're sitting down here, I read that a former Canadian diplomat has been detained in China. So now the game begins here. I don't understand how unilateralism makes America stronger. It seems to me the U.S. is isolating itself more and more from the world.
Yeah, I agree with that. The paradox is that Pompeo is making a bid for unilateralism precisely at the moment when U.S. foreign policy is falling apart. I mean, the U.S. foreign policy is in disarray in Afghanistan, Syria, Saudi Arabia, where the U.S. is a real disaster on its hands with Mohammed bin Salman, and the Ukraine, where essentially Putin has smartly wrapped America's knuckles over the Kerch Strait. So America is actually doing very poorly. But as its performance declines, its rhetoric seems to soar. So now it's talking about imposing American diktat on the entire world. It makes no sense. It's actually quite laughable.
You know, Manuel, in looking at Pompeo's speech, the first thing that came to my mind is, well, what happens if other countries disagree with this unilateralism? What happens when China says no? Russia says no. Iran says no. Even EU says no. I mean, Pompeo didn't seem to really address that, just assuming that everyone is going to agree to American unilateralism. I thought it was a very bizarre speech. Go ahead in Madrid.
Well, I don't think that he was speaking absolutely in terms of unilateralism, back to unilateralism. I think he tried to calm European allies up here, down here. He tried to calm us here because obviously the new policy from a U.S. president is different from the rest, at least since World War II. So basically, instead of having the liberal world order in place as usual, which has been, in my opinion, in general terms, widely beneficial for the world in general terms, even though we can find exceptions, obviously. But instead of following the same procedures as the other presidents, what Mike Pompeo was trying to say is that, yes, we have a president who is a Jacksonian tradition, who is wants to forget about the world only when he's very much interested, and he's going to be very rough. But calm down, don't worry, all his talk about NATO, etc., because we're going to try to keep in place this liberal world order. We're going to keep in place Pax Americana, but we're just going to try to combine it with America first. And I think that combination, I agree in that part, which I also think it is impossible or very difficult to mix. And that's the reason why Europeans here in Germany just basically were not very enthusiastic about. And with regards to your question, what is going to happen? Well, if they pull out and they go back to unilateralism, well, I think the rest of the countries, the rest of the world already see that. So we're just getting into a more, say, dangerous world because we go back to before World War II, where we had unilateralism, bilateral deals, retreat of America from the world, and also basically going back to, instead of multilateralism and collective security concepts, well, going back to balance
but
of power
we're
politics.
Going, okay, if we're going back to before the Second World War, well, what brought about the Second World War? I think, you know, history tells us a lot of things there. Jim, it seems to me that, you know, Pompeo wants to live in a world where the United States determines the geopolitical interests of just about everyone and to determine what kind of friendships other countries can have with other countries. OK, for example, the relationship that Iran has with Syria, that's verboten in the Pompeo world. But I mean, they're two sovereign countries. They decide to cooperate. I mean, that's how we see international law. I worry that international law itself is going to be dispensed with and you'll just have have an American universalized diktat of what is legal and what isn't legal. And of course, it'll be legal to the advantage of one country. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I would agree with everything you said except for the very last part, the advantage of one country. I don't think it's to the advantage of the United States at all.
No, okay, the perception. No, I agree.
This,
the perception that it would be to their advantage. Yeah. Go ahead. Good point. Go ahead.
Exactly.
Keep going, Jim.
That's right. In other words, that this quest for global domination, and that's what it really amounts to. This will end in war, Peter. This is something that is extremely dangerous. One part of Mr. Pompeo's speech really struck me when he talked about sovereignty for ourselves and for our friends.
Friends.
But that means, I guess, we have the unilateral right to say what other countries' sovereignty should be abridged, not because they violated any internationally agreed upon or binding rule, but because we say so. In other words, we have a situation where we're not only one of the players on the international stage, we also get to be the referee and the umpire, and if need be, the executioner. And this cannot end well, Peter, that we cannot continue to divide the world into satellites and vassals on the one side and enemies on the other side, especially when we're lining up with not only Iran, but Russia and China as potential enemies. Remember, there was a recent report by a congressionally mandated commission saying that not only might there be a war with Russia or China, we could lose that war. The unthinkable for 30 years, 40 years during the old Cold War has now become thinkable because of this mindset.
You know, Daniel, going back to Mike Pompeo, I mean, in looking what you know, he's been on hasn't been on the job that I guess 9 months he's been on the job right now. He's probably the most undiplomatic Secretary of State the United States has ever had. I mean, he never talks about diplomacy, and he hates awkward questions that is at odds with his vision, which I'm not particularly sure I understand it completely because it doesn't make any sense logically. But I mean, diplomacy isn't the Secretary of State's strong card, is it?
No, not at all. This administration thoroughly rejects diplomacy in any shape, form, or whatsoever. But the important thing is that the U.S. foreign policy is doing very poorly. The U.S. is struggling on multiple fronts. It's just overstretched. Vis-a-vis China and Russia. It's completely isolated on Iran, except for Saudi Arabia and Israel. No one's lining up behind the U.S. policy there. So America is proclaiming its global sovereignty at a time when its power is increasingly in trouble.
Okay. Manuel, speaking as a European, do you think that Washington should dictate European security, energy security policy, like demanding that Europeans not buy Russian natural gas?
No, I think those comments some time ago with Angela Merkel were very inappropriate because obviously we that's kind of unthinkable, no? That the U.S. president would get into those kind of issues. And besides that, that kind of thing was not a problem to any other former U.S. presidents. But having said that, it is so unthinkable, so strange for him to say that it seems to me that it could be a little bit of politics here and there. He's always on campaign. He has this Russian collusion thing behind, and there might be something, obviously. There's a lot of information out there. So he might be playing a little bit now that he's being tough, rougher than ever on Russia.
I think it's also he wants the Europeans to buy American natural gas through LNG. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Pax Americana. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Jim in Washington. Jim, you said in a previous comment that it was the U.S. would pursue its own interest, and it's the American allies that it were aligned with American interests. But as I mentioned at the end of the first part of the program, energy policy, there's beginning to be a big divergence. And if the Europeans don't fall in line, they're going to be punished, okay? When you look at the sanction warnings about buying Iranian energy, a lot of there were a lot lot of countries that got dispensations, but not really the Europeans. I mean, Donald Trump, because I'm for the complete breakup of NATO and a new security architecture for Europe. I think it's way overdue. But, you know, Donald Trump with this rhetoric coming from his Secretary of State, well, that's just hastening it. It's just bringing it closer to fruition, which I'm actually quite happy about. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, let me throw a little curveball here, Peter, is that the suggestion has been made that Donald Trump is really playing four-dimensional chess here by putting all these neocons in his administration. He is deliberately breaking down all of the things that bind us to these other countries, breaking down the liberal international order by pretending to uphold it, but then failing in doing that. I don't buy any of this, I must say, but some people have this theory. Look, when President Macron of France said, oh, we want to have our own European army, which is a silly idea because Europe really doesn't have any external security threats, you'd think an America First president would say, hey, great, little Macron, that's great. You have your army, we'll get out of NATO, see you around, you have fun over there. Instead, he threatens him. Now, maybe, you know, some people look at pulling out of the INF agreement, as you say, threatening them over energy security. Maybe at some point the Europeans grow a pair and say, we've had enough, and break away and would accomplish just what you were talking about. I don't see that happening, though. I think one of the problems is the European leaders are so weak, so worthless, so willing to be dictated to, that there's no limit to how much they will actually crawl when Washington barks.
You know, Daniel, in a way, the more that the Trump administration bullies, and I think that's an appropriate word, bullies, its European allies, the more that instability that we see, I'm thinking of France right now, the usual two years of nonsense called Brexit. I mean, this should give a lot of Europeans pause about maybe trying to go their own way much more so. I mean, the United States, it's either our way or the highway. Maybe they will start reconsidering some of their policies. And I'm obviously thinking about Russia at this point. We, of course, have these machinations going on in Ukraine, which, unfortunately, the Trump administration continues to support. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I think that James, though, is correct. I mean, I think the Europeans are in such disarray as well these days. They're just too weak to oppose Trump. Trump is weak also, but the Europeans, for the moment, seem to be even weaker. So it's a kind of a battle of the weak. And it's very hard to establish any kind of broader leadership in this increasingly chaotic environment we find ourselves in. But, you know, but that said, but trouble is breaking out all over the place, and especially the Iranian situation, Iran and Syria and Israel and Saudi Arabia is increasingly dangerous. But also the U.S. seems intent on pouring oil on the fire.
You know, Manuel, you know, Iran was just mentioned right here. And you've written a book about Pax Americana. I mean, I understood the post-World War II order that was created by the United States. I understand the intent behind it in the context of the Cold War. But after the Cold War and the rise of this kind of neocon ideology, I mean, a sane person wouldn't say, focus all of American foreign policy on Iran. I mean, that's obviously politics going on there. And also, if you look at some of the issues that the U.S. is intruding upon on the Korean Peninsula, I mean, the Koreans are actually making some progress moving towards peace there, but the U.S. is dragging its feet, and it is planning, it's seemingly so, planning a war against Iran. How is that possibly in the interest of anyone, including Americans?
Well, it's very difficult to understand. That's why I sometimes say that the only explanation possible is that some people in the administration are very much influenced by people that have an outlook which is very far away from the Western outlook, which is very dualistic, Manichaean, and it comes from say, a very dualistic view of the world, which has some apocalyptic connotations.
Yeah.
Some of the advisors and even Mike Pompeo himself is thinking that if things get worse, it's okay, because in the Middle East, there's going to something is going to happen called Armageddon, and everything is going to be fine after that. So if we mess the whole thing up, nothing is going to happen. I find that explanation quite plausible, because otherwise you wouldn't understand what happened with Bush and Iraq in 2003 and some other presidents. I mean, and it's a total opposite vision to what Barack Obama or even Bill Clinton and even George Herbert Walker Bush, who died recently, had to do with. I mean, it's an opposite vision. It's opposite to the Western values and to the Western outlook, and it has absolute nonsense. But the thing is, in order to understand it, I think you have to put yourself in his shoes, in his feet, and understand that they have a very different outlook that has to do with that. It has to do with prophecies on the future.
It's very interesting. You know, Jim, it seems to me, Daniel's already mentioned on this program, is that on so many different levels and dimensions, American foreign policy is very chaotic right now. There's no rhyme or reason to it that I can see. But one thing I think Pompeo and his ilk are responding to is the unipolar moment is either already over or it's rapidly coming to an end. And I think that explains this sudden reaction, you know, with all these posture reports about picking enemies, preparing for conflict and all, because the unipolar moment was supposed to last forever. It was the new radiant future. No, it has come to, it's coming to a close, and the U.S. Is lashing out because it feels that its hegemonic moment is evaporating before its eyes. Go ahead, Jim.
You mean the thousand-year unipolar moment isn't going to last that long?
Yeah.
Look, I agree with that, Peter, and I think part of the problem is that we're not looking at a pre-World War II situation. We're looking at a pre-World War I situation. That the United States insists, and when I say United States, I mean this really bad foreign policy team that Mr. Trump has assembled, if they insist on trying to perpetuate a unipolar moment, global hegemony that is visibly failing, instead of coming to terms with the other rising powers, particularly Russia and China, to maybe some extent with India, to come up with a stable concert of powers, understood spheres of influence, where we don't clash, we stay out of each other's business, we stay out of each other's face. Unless that happens relatively soon, something very, very bad is going to happen. And I think right now, the top contender for that is Ukraine, where Mr. Poroshenko, because of his dismal reelection bid, is staging the provocations like he did in the Kerch Strait. He's going after churches and monasteries in Ukraine, which is going to result in violence. And I think Russia may have to respond. Things are going to get very ugly fairly soon. We don't know where or how, unless somehow we pull back from trying to maintain a global dominance that simply cannot be continued.
You know, Daniel, and I look at all of us here on this program here, and we're in the same generation, okay? We all brought up, being aware of the possibility of war. The Cold War, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. And, you know, it seems to me that the policymakers now are not as wary as war as they should be. I mean, now there's a nuclear doctrine where they're conceiving of making small nukes, you know, for a battlefield. I remember in the 1980s, that was scoffed at as total madness. And now we've gone back to it. It seems like these people in power don't understand that how close we can come to a conflict. Because, you know, living here in Russia will do everything to protect its sovereignty. And it's made that clear to everyone. But that's heard on deaf ears by people like Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I agree totally. The abrogation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty is very dangerous. I mean, the U.S. is walking away from some very important nuclear arms accords that were hammered out in the last years of the Cold War, and now it's just casting them aside. This is amazingly irresponsible, amazingly reckless, but the U.S. is doing it, and it's almost impossible to imagine what the repercussions will be. But it's important to bear in mind that the old Pax Americana 1.0 is falling apart. Trump has no idea what to replace it with, because he's just crazy. But there's, you know, he's reasserting U.S. Unilateralism at a time when the chaos is increasing and the U.S. actually has diminishing power. And I think it's very important to point out what's one country which is pushing these, bringing things to the breaking point. And that's Israel. I mean, Israel is the major force in Washington. It's very influential in Washington, as we all know. And it is the country which is pushing for a rupture with Iran and pushing for action against Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And essentially, Israel is the one country on earth that America can't say no to. So Israel is kind of calling the shots, and Israel's confrontation with Iran is deepening, and that conflict seems to be unstoppable. Many other conflicts.
Right,
as well.
If I can stay with you, we only have a few more seconds left here. Add to that, I'm agreeing with you. One more layer, and the now open alliance that Riyadh has with Tel Aviv, and they are like-minded in their objectives to confront Iran.
Yes, but the Riyadh regime is falling apart before our very eyes. I mean, that regime is in an advanced state of crisis. I don't know what'll replace it in the next year or so. But MBS can't stay in power, and the Al Saud are themselves falling apart. So what's going to happen in Saudi Arabia? I mean, U.S. is relying on Saudi Arabia, but it's the most, it's chosen
okay, well,
the, a
they've
bankrupt,
chosen very bad
you know,
allies in the region. We've run out of time, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, New York, and in Madrid. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.